The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hello, friends, and welcome to a very special edition of the Bill Press Pod. You know, two of the most interesting people in the country today are Jerry Brown, former four-term, 16-year governor of California, a good friend whom I had the honor of working with for 4 years, and Pete Buttigieg, mayor of South Bend, Indiana, who has surged to the top four of Democratic candidates running for president in 2020. One toward the end of his long career in public service, the other near the beginning. Well, I figured the two of them would have a lot to talk about, and so, with a few phone calls, the help of mutual friends, and a lot of luck, I was able to bring Jerry Brown and Pete Buttigieg together for you. And Jerry jumped right into foreign policy.
Pete, really good to be with you.
Same here. Nice to be connected again.
I'd like to get your sense of where we are in Syria. I mean, millions of migrants have destabilized the politics in Europe, particularly in Germany and Italy. So many people have been killed, women, children, the gas attacks, all the rest of it. So what are your thoughts on Syria? What is America's role? What should it have been? And where the heck do we go from here?
Well, I think America's priority has to be ensuring American safety. And we have to accept the fact that there are problems that we can solve, and then there are problems that you'll just have to manage. And unfortunately, I think for the near term, a lot of the problems in the Middle East and in that region are in that second category, problems that we got to manage in a way that is responsible and that keeps America safe. But that does not mean we shoulder the burden of what the outcomes are going to be. I actually think that was the direction we were working in prior to the president's recent decision. In other words, we had a very, very small number of highly specialized people on the ground who were really all that stood between that region and the beginnings of a potential genocide, as well as the reemergence of ISIS. Those forces have now been unleashed because of the president's decision to effectively betray Kurdish fighters who had been very good allies to the United States. And I think the ramifications of that decision go far beyond Syria alone. They really go to American credibility on the world stage. The truth is, sometimes part of how we stay out of a conflict, or at least stay out of having large numbers of U.S. troops get entangled or involved somewhere, is because of our alliances, because we're part of a bigger international community that can manage problems or deal with things. If we undercut alliances, or really undercut our ability to even form alliances, which, of course, is what happens if we send the signal that it's not a safe bet to count on America's word, well, the consequence of that is going to be that the world will become an even more unstable and dangerous place.
Well, now, if we have to manage, which we obviously do, these conflicts in the Middle East, how about Turkey? Turkey isn't a lie. It's part of NATO. We certainly have some issues with them. But where do we go now?
Well, it's tough when it comes to Syria, because it seems the horse is out of the barn, and it's difficult even to gauge what the state of play will be more than a year from now when the new president takes office. But what I will say is that we know that many of the biggest consequences of President Trump abandoning American values has to do with the behavior not of our adversaries, but our allies. We know that our strategic competitors, Russia, China, are going to act in problematic ways if we don't have a smart strategy. But one of the things we've seen is countries we think of as our allies, from Saudi Arabia to Turkey, also behave in ways that are destructive when we give the green light for that sort of thing, as we did with Saudi Arabia's murder of a journalist after the fact, and as we did with Turkey before the fact. Now, we should acknowledge that Turkey does have legitimate security interests on their border, that there is a ton of complexity. to what's going on in terms of their concerns about the Kurdish fighters. But that's just the point, is that we had a comparatively stable state of play. And now we've unleashed the kind of chaos that's associated with potential ethnic cleansing and ISIS fighters going free. We need to use, precisely because we are allies or NATO and treaty allies, because of this, we actually have more of an opportunity to influence what's going on for good there than we would with a player like, for example, Iran, which is an adversary that we have less and less leverage over, especially since pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal. So all of these add up to why you can't just have an impulsive, reckless decision and expect it to be something you can get away with, or expect its consequences to be confined to one region. And managing the alliance with Turkey is going to require a president who will use the fact that that we are allies as a way to ensure that the worst behaviors and impulses of our allies are held in check.
Well, now in Turkey, we know we've got 60 nuclear bombs there that are ready to be delivered, been there for decades as part of our strategy to defend against the Soviet Union. And Turkey's not alone. I think there are nuclear weapons of the United States in Belgium, also the Netherlands. But that raises the point in managing this very complicated relationship with Turkey. What about the nukes? Do you think that extended deterrence reaches the point where maintaining nuclear weapons in a country like Turkey makes sense? Or do we have to find a way to pull back on our forward positioning of nuclear weapons?
Well, I think we need to continuously reevaluate our strategic posture and look at whether it's consistent with our interests, with regional security, and with American values. What we know is that a precipitous decision has terrible knock-on consequences, but we should make sure for the long run that we have a sustainable and affordable policy when it comes to force projection, whether it's with weaponry or with people.
Well, now, you use the word precipitous. I would have to say that the withdrawal from the anti-ballistic missile treaty by President Bush, that was precipitous. The withdrawal by Trump from the INF, the Intermediate Nuclear Force Treaty, that was precipitous. That both those treaties were negotiated by Republican presidents, one by Nixon, one by Reagan. And now Trump is saying he's going to pull out of the Open Skies Treaty, which allows Americans and other nations and Russia to see what's going on in the air in a way that creates more transparency. And now we got New START, which is the last remaining major treaty between Russia and the United States. There's a lot of talk that Trump wants to pull out of that. So what do you think of all these treaties? They were the essence of our nuclear security, the architecture of engagement with Russia, with the Soviet Union. So where are we now?
Well, I'm from Indiana, which is the home state of Dick Lugar, a senator who was together with Sam Nunn behind a number of the strategic nuclear weapons reduction treaties that were really key to our engagement with Russia in the years immediately after the post-Cold War, led to the destruction of many nuclear weapons and unquestionably made the world a safer place. We clearly see movements in the wrong direction going on now. Now, some of these things were connected to legitimate concerns. You look at the INF treaty withdrawal. There's no question that there were a lot of issues with Russian compliance, but I think that the impulsiveness of this administration led to this assumption that nothing is better than something, which just isn't true. The solution to the problems with Russian compliance in the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty wasn't to blow it up altogether. The solution would be to try to come out with a stronger agreement than we had. And we need to move, into the direction of greater, not reduced frameworks for the process that's going to lead to strategic reduction, because it's in nobody's interest for us to have this level of buildup continue indefinitely around the world.
Yeah, we got these weapons. I think the estimate is given that the U.S. has approximately 7,000 nuclear warheads. We have almost the same number in reserve, but thousands at the ready to be launched literally within hours if the word comes from the president. On the other hand, the Russians have an equal number ready to go. And we know from the past that there have been mistakes that Russians thought we'd launch several hundred missiles toward them. And there was a mistake during the time when Bill Perry was Secretary of Defense under Bill Clinton, where they thought that the Russians had launched. And it turned out in both cases a mistake. So there's a lot of talk on Capitol Hill with Trump and the interference with the election and lots of other misdeeds on the part of Mr. Putin. But the reality, the brute reality, is we have thousands of weapons that if by some blunder something gets going, it could escalate and you could actually eliminate human civilization. So given all this difficulty and tension, in many ways name-calling with Russia, how do you see moving in the direction where we return to a point of nuclear stability, such that when there was Senator Lugar, he certainly was a Republican championing that. But we're far from that. People are treating the existence of these nuclear weapons as though it's not real, that there isn't this danger of nuclear annihilation. And the most important thing are tweets from the president or calling Putin names or focusing on the latest guy that he's killed or something. But the big question is, how do we return to more nuclear safety and security?
Well, I think there are going to have to be incremental steps that probably start very small just because the trust now is so low. Now, we've got to retain the ability to respond when Russia undertakes actions like what they did to interfere with our election, using diplomatic and economic and informational and other tools. And we need to begin by ensuring that we're deterring the escalation of conventional conflicts, especially when we're in a region or dealing with a player that also has nuclear capabilities. We've got to make sure that as few conventional conflicts emerge as possible. And then when they do, we've got to make sure that they can be managed with the lowest possible likelihood of escalating into a nuclear confrontation. As long as these levels of armament exist, deterrence and de-escalation are going to be critical. And we need to have relationships and communications channels that continue to minimize risk in a way that, unfortunately, the current chaos of the administration in particular and the environment in general is making harder and harder to do.
This special episode of the Bill Press Pod is brought to you by
the International Association of Firefighters, those great men and women of our firefighting departments. We see them rushing by all the time on the way to help American families. That's who they are. They're on the front lines protecting American families every day. We count on them. They never let us down. Under the leadership of President Harold Schaeferger, we thank them for their support of the Bill Press Pod and direct you to find out more about their great work at their website, IAFF.org.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
years ago, NATO stopped at Germany, and then the decision was made to proceed to include countries to the east, Poland, Czechoslovakia, and others. And then George Bush, he added further. So now Russia's pretty well surrounded, and we're obligated under Article 5 to defend Latvia and Lithuania and Estonia, even to the point, I suppose, of a new war. And then there's talk about Ukraine, also Georgia going into NATO. Have you given any thought to how do we deal with, on the one hand, deterring Russia, but on the other hand, not so encircling them that we provoke the very thing we fear?
Well, I think there is certainly a perception on the side of the Russian regime that the United States is intent on regime change. And any actions that we take that would seem to confirm or corroborate that perception are likely going to lead to even greater mistrust and potentially more actions that are destabilizing. So when you think about NATO, it's certainly the case that it's an institution that needs to evolve, as do a lot of our international institutions. The alliance has had considerable value. I served under a NATO command when I was deployed in Afghanistan. But we do need to assess every time there is talk of accession or an issue around one of the treaty countries that we're not taking any step that could simply lead to greater tension. And we need to make sure that the regional security frameworks are strong enough that the individual states, especially on the periphery of Russia, don't feel that their security depends on either one way or the other, aligning themselves in a way that could be destabilizing.
Talking about agreements, we have the Paris Agreement, one of the real hopeful signs and major milestones. Have you thought about how do we go from here?
Well, I think the road ahead is going to be challenging any way you cut it. And yet, you know, I think if we zoom out and look at the big picture, there's a big opportunity here. Look, the U.S. has a credibility problem, and the world has a climate problem. And if the U.S. does what we do best, which is to say lead on climate, it's actually perhaps the best chance we have to restore American credibility on the global stage. And if there was such a thing as climate diplomacy being very important globally, it's an example of one of the ways that we might be back on the front foot with respect to a player like China. So not only do we need to restore commitments like the Paris Accord, of course, which I consider to be really table stakes at this point, but we should recognize that two things are true. One, the U.S. cannot solve climate alone because we represent less than 20% of the emissions. And secondly, it's unlikely that the world can address climate change without us. That means that American leadership is going to be more important than ever. But for us to show leadership on the world stage on this issue, which I really view as a security issue, in order for us to lead on this issue, we got to be practicing what we preach here at home. And it's one of the reasons why a robust climate plan is so important.
So let's get into that. The notion by 2045, 2050 at the latest, the world's going to get to a net zero emission. That's quite ambitious, but they're saying that's what we need to do just to stay even under 2 degrees, let alone 1.5 degrees centigrade. So what kind of a program, not just a resolution like the Green New Deal, but how in the world can we change our infrastructure, electricity, building, appliances? There's an opportunity there, but boy, is there a huge challenge.
It's really going to have to be a national mobilization. And the good news is that America generally does better when we have a big national project. And this one, unlike, say, the Cold War, doesn't involve fighting other people. The challenge, of course, is that it's going to require a lot more of us than we've put in to date. But I believe with presidential leadership, we can rally the American people, recruit the American people to get this done. My plan calls for us to double clean sources on our energy grid by 2025, and then start working toward making first light transportation and then heavy transportation carbon neutral as 2040 approaches, so that we do reach that goal of net zero by 2050. It means investing in renewable energy, energy storage, and carbon storage. roughly quadrupling the current level of federal R&D so that we were over $20 billion a year. It's going to require a carbon tax, which I would structure as a tax and dividend that is repaid back out to the American people on a progressive basis. So that, because the idea isn't to suck money out of the economy. The idea is just to make sure that our prices accurately reflect the impact of their carbon footprint. If we take these steps now, it's not too late. But I think in many ways, you know, the IPCC says we have until 2030 to act decisively. I think the real deadline is 2020, because if we don't have a political decision in 2020 that's going to lead to the right kind of leadership in the White House, then there's just no way we can get to the steps we will have to take by 2030 in order to be on the footing we need to be by 2050.
Well, California has been a pretty good model here. It's probably the most aggressive climate state in terms of actions that it's taken. Half the electric cars in America are now sold in California. The vehicle standards are the toughest coming out of that state. We've got about 25% renewable electricity. We have building standards. We have appliance standards. But having said all that, there's still a long, long way to go. California is by no means where it needs to be. But I can tell you, having presided over that much of that for 8 years, tremendous political resistance. How do we change the car fleet, the embedded electricity? We've got 40% electricity is coming from coal. How do we move off that? And then building standards, appliances. We're talking not, you know, a few billions. This is major transformation. And I wonder if you've thought of the political moves that you'd have to make to even get this done.
The biggest thing that I think has to happen politically is to make sure everybody understands what they have to gain by it. That's everything from making sure people see how they can benefit from jobs that are going to be created. And sometimes we talk about green jobs like they're these exotic, newfangled things, but a lot of what needs to be done are jobs that already exist right now, insulators and glaziers and carpenters and electrical workers all across the building trades as well as in manufacturing. We estimate a net gain of 3 million jobs from the climate plan we're putting out. I also think it's very important that we engage rural America here. Agriculture can be a big part of the solution. And if we get it right, then we have an opportunity to use farms, use soil and cover crops for carbon capture. After all, the original carbon capture technology is plants. And if we get that right, I think about it in terms of politics, because I think it gives us the chance to allow people in more conservative areas who maybe feel like they've been sort of beaten over the head and told they're the problem, instead allows them to picture where they fit in the solution. And I think it's critically important that we move climate beyond being a partisan and political issue, because it's just too important. And but that means we got to do a better job of recruiting and enlisting the contributions of people from every sector of society so that people stand up taller and so that the emotion you feel when you're thinking about climate is less one of guilt and more one of pride.
When you talk about transforming the economy, whether you call it green or renewable or sustainable, that brings up the idea of infrastructure. President Trump, just a couple of years ago, was calling for a $1 trillion infrastructure program. Now, his was very much bricks and mortar, roads and bridges, which has to be a part of it. But if we're going to change the way we move around in cars and trucks and trains and how we generate electricity and how our buildings function and how our appliances also function, that's a huge infrastructure program. But getting the trillion, he never could face the music here and say, okay, how are we going to pay for it? And while he had a lot of carpenters and operating engineers and those kind of people wanting to get on board, not much appetite on the Republicans, particularly in the Senate. Transforming is going to be a big, big project that can put people in the country and the farming areas as well in the cities. It could be a big source of jobs. It would be, but it's going to take some money, and that's going to take some Republicans as well as Democrats.
Well, needless to say, I think we need a better Senate. And part of my objective as a candidate for president is to be the kind of candidate from the middle of the country with coattails who can help us make sure we've got better legislators in D.C. I think we've also got to make clear what the benefits are and make it clear to constituents to the point that their legislators in Washington have to start following them. One of the things I've noticed as a mayor is that at a local level, even very conservative areas will often vote for a levy or a tax if it means if they know exactly what it's going to go for, and it's better roads or a new school or something whose benefit is clear. And we need to make sure that we're doing that at the national level, too. I remember when President Trump came in thinking maybe he really will do infrastructure. Maybe that's the one promise he'll keep, because I figured it would be good politics for him and get some bipartisan support. But as you point out, when it came time to pay for it, basically, all they had to offer when it came time to pay for it was that we'd pay for it locally, which is what we've been doing all along. We need to make sure there's an actual mobilization of federal resources to do things that the American people are very, very eager to see done. And that will require rolling back some of the Trump tax cuts, especially on corporations, and closing corporate loopholes and asking the wealthiest among us to pay their fair share. But then the American people support that. We just got to make sure that there's a political cost if members of the House and Senate continue to ignore the American people on an issue that important.
Well, in California, the Republicans put a bill to repeal our gas tax. We put on a bill, 12 cents gas tax. And so they put that as a referendum to put before the people. Do you want it or not? And it turned out the people overwhelmingly, by over 10 points, voted for it. And the campaign did not talk about tax, even though it was a tax. They talked about the projects in the areas, whether it be San Diego or Los Angeles, San Francisco Bay Area, what you would lose and what you get. Now, if you're talking about a whole transformation based on sustainability and renewable energy, that could create a lot of benefit, very visible, very local, and you might be able to get a funding mechanism from a broad-based tax. I mean, without that, we can't reach the magnitude of effort needed. So do you think there's enough will, or could you generate that as president?
Well, I think that's part of what presidential leadership is for, is to get the American people excited and energized for an investment that's worth doing. As you point out from that experience in state, when people see what they have to gain, they will very often support investing in it. And we have some big investments that we got to make as a country. We've been deferring those investments for too long at a very great cost. And we've seen what the consequences of that are. This is our chance to get things right and to invest in the kinds of infrastructure and in the kind of future that we're going to need if we want to be competitive, if we want to compete with China, if we want to create a good future for coming generations, certainly if we want to get ahead of this climate issue, then we have got to be willing to make the investments that are needed. I think Americans want it. We just got to have a president who insists on delivering.
Now, if you could link the need to transform the infrastructure, the way America works, factories, transportation, housing, electricity, and power. If you can link that with dealing with the other big problem, and that is there's so many Americans that are struggling, that can't afford decent housing, that are really sinking, and whether you call them low income or forgotten Americans, a lot of people who didn't go to college, who you might even call them swing voters in some states like Ohio and Pennsylvania, they're not doing that well. Even in California, we have a high number of people that, by some measures, are put in a poverty category. So that is a big elephant in the room. What can you do to lift up that big segment of America? At least it could be a fifth or more of people that really are not enjoying the American dream. It's also the whole issue of inequality, but it's also just lifting up, seeing those boats at the bottom rise.
Well, one of the fundamental problems of our time is that the economy is growing, and yet that rising tide does not lift all boats, doesn't even lift up most of them in many ways. And sometimes I think the conversation has made things too complicated. The biggest problem is people aren't getting paid enough. And that's especially true of people who are working in some of the fastest growing jobs in the country, who are often disproportionately women and workers of color, too. But in every part of the country, we're seeing the consequences of our economy developing to where the costs are going up faster than people's income. The cost of education, saving for retirement, housing, health are shooting up. And, you know, if you start the clock the day I was born, for something like half of Americans, income has barely budged at all in that entire period, despite the tremendous growth that's happened nationally. And that's not the result of some mysterious, unstoppable cosmic force. It's the result of specific policy and political decisions that were made in Washington, D.C., with different and better decisions. We can have a different and better trend in this country, one toward equality, one toward low-income people having a shot at becoming middle or high-income people. And if we lose that American dream, which is very much on the decline in this country, there's not going to be much left.
Mayor Pete, thanks so much. We'll let you get back to campaigning.
Sure thing. It's an honor to be with both of you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Great. I really enjoyed it, and good luck.
Same here. Thanks very much.
So Jerry, I got to ask you, you were asking about the climate change. I mean, as governor of California, you spent a lot of time on climate change. What role do you see that the president of the United States and the governors have in making that happen?
Well, the big role immediately is to put more money into investment, battery technology, all the other things. It could be even advanced computing, but the electricity, how it's generated, how it's stored, the cars that depend on batteries, the factories, how they run, cement industry, how it operates. There's lots of need for basic research and also more practical downstream research that can help industry transform itself. So that's real money. We're not talking billions here. We're talking tens of billions and trillions over time. That's a big part. Then secondly, you got to have the rules. You got to have the EPA, all the 50 different environmental rules that Trump has repealed or attempted to repeal. You've got to put those back on the books, reinvigorate them, leave all the efforts of Trump, get rid of that and get back and go beyond, because you have to set intelligent ground rules for how the economy works that will get us off fossil fuels, reduce and ultimately get to a net zero emission of carbon. And that is quintessentially the president and the Congress. Of course, the president can't do it alone. Trump's done a lot of destructive things by executive order. Going forward and meeting the challenge of the Paris Agreement is going to take Congress. And to get Congress going, you've got to mobilize the whole country. So I think the steps are relatively clear. The politics is formidable.
And that's a wrap for this special episode of the Bill Press Pod, an in-depth conversation between Governor Jerry Brown and Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Thanks again to Governor Brown and Pete Buttigieg. And thanks to all of you for listening. And now we offer you our own quid pro quo. The quid, we bring you two great podcasts from the Bill Press Pod every week. And the quo, you simply sign up for the Bill Press Pod by going to Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or TuneIn, search for the Bill Press Pod, and subscribe. It's that simple, and it's free. And even better, while you're there, give us a big 5-star review. Nothing's more important in helping us grow the Bill Press Pod. Again, thanks to the governor and to Mayor Pete. Thanks to all of you for listening. Also, don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Bill Press Pod, so you'll get an alert when each new podcast is posted. Meanwhile, stay strong, and we'll see you on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.